Hi, I'm Lashana Lynch, and you are listening to the Post-Credit Scene podcast.
Shout out to Catherine Hahn, though. Wow, she's a talented actress, man. Didn't even get to speak about Agatha, to be fair, but that was a good series in the end. It was actually a good series. Yeah, it was actually quite good.
Bro, solid series.
It's actually good, yeah.
Solid series.
So I've heard.
It started off really solid, though. It was pissing me off.
I liked the first episode.
Sorry. Probably. It was good. And then, do you remember...
Child stuff you got a bit bored of.
Like 3-4.
Yeah.
3-4, I was like, bro, come on.
Last episode was probably the best of the season for me. I love the last episode, man.
How many episodes is it?
It's
9.
9, yeah?
Okay. And they brought 8 and 9.
Episodes. How
many minutes per episode?
23.
No, it's like 30-ish.
Cap.
Oh, that's okay.
Bro,
like that's doable.
6 max. Check. Bro, no, it says 30. But
I know, that includes everything else.
It includes like a 7 minute fucking credits.
The first couple are like in the 40s, I remember. Check it. Anyway, it's not worth the check now. We'll talk about it.
But yeah, it's a good watch.
Okay.
Easy watch.
And like they only go off the MCU a little bit. Like I would say relevantly. You know what I'm saying? And then, yeah.
But it's dope. I'm slapping the background to see how I feel.
Yeah. We should chop this cut him, by the way. These men have been stoning us. Anyways, go on.
Yeah, Catherine Hahn, she's a G. Shout out to her. We are the Post Credit Scene Podcast, a 14 HQ original lovers of film, TV and theatre. And we are back in the studio for a big episode today, to be fair. For one of the most highly anticipated films of the year, shall I say. In tandem with a general catch-up in terms of things we've been watching, because we've been quite busy ourselves with sort of other projects and films and shows that we've had to sort of work on. Day of the Jackal, which is currently on Sky Now, which we worked on with Sky and Lashana Lynch's team, which was really, really cool. So yes, make sure check out our...
Go on, sorry.
What was you going to
say?
Just make sure to check out our recent interview with Lashana Lynch, which is on all DSPs, so Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Make sure to check out on YouTube as well. You can go now.
And also, I think by the time this comes out or around, also Jason's interview with Pippin. Actually, you know what? You go ahead.
So I didn't know this, but yeah. So hopefully. The interview for Pimpinero Blood and Oil will be out. I interviewed one of the lead actresses.
She's beautiful, man.
And the director, of the film.
He was lovely, you know.
Yeah, really, really good. He was really good.
And he was really lovely.
Yeah, super nice guy. I don't know why not that I was expecting him to be like a dickhead or anything like that, but I didn't think he would be as friendly as he was. I thought he'd be a little bit more apprehensive, but he was super awesome. Engaging, super talkative, and made the entire experience a lot easier as well. So nice. shouts out to them, shouts out to Amazon as well. That's for it, giving man. Us that opportunity.
Yes, sir. As we said, there's been quite a lot of releases in like the last month, which we haven't had the time to necessarily break down. So we're going to spend some time talking about those alongside films and shows we have been watching but maybe haven't necessarily been released in the last month or so. Hopefully we have enough time to get through all of that. But we do have a task today to talk about one of the most highly anticipated films of the year.
Yes,
there was a lot of talk about this film prior to its release, which I'm sure we're going to get into because Jason has a lot to say. We've seen sort of journalists, critics, people of standing within the film and TV community who had a lot to say about Gladiator 2, people that went to sort of early screenings and so on and so forth. So we'll get into that. Firstly, how are you guys feeling and doing? How's everyone feeling today?
Bloody tired, mate.
Yeah, man. It's that coming to that time of the year as well, isn't it?
I was in North West London last night at like 1 a.m. But just before I left, I went to my friend's house. The way that he looked at me. So said it all.
Shout out me, man.
For what?
I'm going to see you in like about an hour.
Yeah.
I was out at a thingy at Box Park still.
No, I went to my friend's house because she recently moved into a place and she wanted to get some stuff built. So a few of us went there and also nice little chill time, ended up playing some games, got home like just before 2. But before I left, I was like, bro, I have to come back to fucking West London in like 8 hours.
Blame it so long.
Shout out to come stay at mine. No, I've got 2 home. Spare rooms.
I love that, but I wanted to go home.
I'm saying next time, okay, go, bring a bag or something, come with me, fam.
You can watch movies together like them to you.
No.
Maybe you know. We can watch some anime. Yeah, come.
Gladiator 2. Obviously, it's like, yes. It's a sequel to the much loved and much adored first Gladiator film, which came out in the year 2000. A highly acclaimed film with lots of awards, Oscars, Oscar winners, one of the most decorated directors ever in Ridley Scott, arguably to say. Before we get into our thoughts about the sequel, how did Gladiator as a film resonate with you guys when you first watched it? And where does it stand for you now? I'll go over to you, Horse, first. I feel as though, I don't know why, I could be so wrong. I feel like you're the Gladiator guy here, but I could be wrong.
Love Gladiator.
Why?
Love it. It was one of those films, like, I told you guys, like, previously, my dad loves, like, fantastical war films, you know what I'm saying? Mm. He loved, like, Star Wars and, you know, that. So even, like, Gladiator, like, you know, back then, I think it came out in 1999 or 2000.
2000,
yeah. 2000 on the dot. That was a film that he thought was really, really cool. Do you know what I mean? So then, it's actually got, I think, I've only said this like once this year for David Jackal, but it's got a fantastic opening scene. It's got such an incredible opening scene. It goes like straight into this like war, and you have immediate respect for Maximus, like straight away, and then you just know like the loyalty that he's got to Caesar, and like from that moment, okay, you just like respect his whole character. Now the film is written a bit up and downish, okay, like sometimes when you some of the plot is so thickle, but it's so dramatic, right, that it kind of like blurs over it. But the overall layering of the film, and to think like the sets that they built then, you know what I'm saying, and it was gory, and it still kind of had, you know, a titular like storyline. Yeah, it was honestly like a really good film. I rewatched it just before I watched this one, and I rewatched it again last night.
It's a film originally without, if you take away the action and the spectacle of it all. It's a film about politics in one realm and then family politics in another. Yeah. Sort of a child's jealousy over the relationship between Marcus Aurelius and Maximus, which is essentially the spine of the story. Mm. Then you've got other aspects like Commodus's love for his sister, which is creepy in of itself. You've got the whole sort of his adoration yet jealousy for Maximus, which is, I guess, the heart of the film, which drives a lot of the actions.
Yeah.
Gladiator 2. Let's get immediate thoughts, just quickly, quick premise, like 1 minute, each of us just share your overall on the film, and then we can delve into sort of like the bits and the nicks and the crux. Manny?
Yeah, wasn't a fan of the film. I remember coming out the cinema, feeling very much felt underwhelmed. I sat with it a bit more, and sometimes the film's a bit empty. It feels like a copy and paste of the first film to an extent with some edits, but it doesn't feel...
some edits and an upgraded camera.
Yeah, this, if this was put through Turn It In, it wouldn't pass. It will be flagged.
Jesus.
Quick. We'll get into deeper into what I actually dislike about the film and stuff that I actually did like about the film. But overall, it is a disappointment and a big issue that I just have in general with like quite a lot of Hollywood films and big blockbusters and the amount of resources they have to create films that could be good. But then you do stuff like this, it's kind of jarring.
Yeah.
Through the whole landscape of what cinema and film could potentially be versus to what it is.
Of course.
I disagree. I think it was a solid film for what it is. I think it had better individual performances in this one than it did in the first one, right? I think that the storyline, you're right, was obviously, you know, very Top Gun Maverick-ish, you know what I mean, where like they kind of took the same storyline from the first one, remixed it, you know what I'm saying, little DJ Khaled, and then boom, you know, here we are. But like, the thing is, if we didn't get so many Hollywood blockbuster bombs where they were doing this yet, we wouldn't be so like apprehensive. But I'm not mad at the retelling or the reimagining of some stories. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Okay, and that's the thing, we're so angry with like sequels and franchises and blah blah blah, that like actually the reason why they worked back then was because there wasn't so many of them, right? Whereas like this could actually fall into like that category where I think it's a solid film, not as globally, you know, successful as Maverick, but I think it had very good individual performances. I think it actually had a better storyline towards the end. I think that's where the first film
this is so funny.
Really
like, falls off.
This is so funny.
Yeah,
this is so funny because we were well. I wasn't on time. I'll put it out there, but Jason was on time. So when I got in.
Jason was here last night.
we were talking about the film. You know how you accidentally get into those sort of conversations before you start podding.
Of course.
Yeah. And you start podding before you're podding. And yeah, Jason, you want to take off from where Huss left, especially with the final third of the film?
I thought the final third of the film didn't need to exist. Just kind of like on my quick thoughts, I think I agree with Huss in the sense that there were definitely good individual performances, but I think overall the film left me it wasn't a bad film, it wasn't a shit film, I'm not saying it's a shit film, but it was just left me a little bit really underwhelmed from kind of like I think Gaz mentioned it earlier, like people who went to kind of like the early screenings and so on and so forth, and the way they were talking about it, like, you know, top five film of the year, this mm-hmm. best film that they've seen of the year, and going in to watch that film, I did not get any of that at all. And obviously we all make our own opinions and stuff like that, but I think and this was off screen, you know, I made a point of kind of like a sense of like journalistic integrity, like the film, like when I was sitting watching the film, it started making me think about most of the content creators who went on and said like this is a must watch, like to come away from the film, I would have thought to myself like, yo, you could wait until this is on Netflix or something like that. This isn't a film that this is a must watch. But some of the performances though were absolutely fire. Like, we'll get into it proper, but I do think there will be an Academy nomination for somebody in that.
Yeah, but where you think it goes is going to be different.
Where I think it goes. That's why I didn't want to mention it. But I reckon, like, I just want to see like where everyone thought when we get into it. But overall, meh. That's what I think kind of like of the film. But I don't think it's the worst watch of the year for sure, or by any stretch of the means, really.
Fair. I think it's a good film. It's a good flawed film. Like. It has so many strong points, but it probably has as many weak points, which is where I'm not going to give my rating, but I have it just above middling as a film, because some of the strong points of the film I genuinely really, really, really enjoyed. There's some really strong acting performances in the film.
There's some scenes you go raw.
Some of the action is really engrossing as well. I think it's definitely a step up in the action from the first film, which you naturally would expect anyway. That's just the thing you'd expect in terms of evolution of filmmaking and so on and so forth. But yeah, I have as many issues with the film as I enjoyed it. But I think the parts I enjoyed somewhat overshine my huge issues, which exist. So there's a real duality in how I felt about this film, especially as the more I sort of sat with it over time. Mm. But yeah, let's get into it. The film follows Lucius Verus, who's essentially, the film opens with him involved in a war against the Roman Empire. And he essentially gets sold as a slave, right? And this is where he sort of meets Denzel's character, Macrinus.
Wife dies first, remember?
I know it's important. I know it's
copying.
Yeah. It's an important part of the film. I just really didn't care. I didn't care. Really.
Yeah.
I know
it's an important part.
Yeah.
I'm just adding on to that.
No, that can be his motivation, right? But I feel like in the way it was, and I mean, we'll get
that
to
was
it
his
more.
Entire motivation.
Yeah, that was his entire motivation. But like, we'll get to it more when we I feel like get into the negatives. But I feel like,
can I just say, before we even get onto that, the fact that he's his son, in a sense.
Bro, that's another issue that I had.
Yeah, fair enough.
All over my guy from the first film, bro.
Yeah,
that's what the film did. It's kind of nasty, because I feel like going back to Gladiator 1, knowing his character, you would know if that's his son, if Lucius was his son. And then there's a scene that they have in Gladiator 1.
Right at the start, right?
The flirting is like, oh, I have a son.
Oh, Connie Nielsen.
I have a son around the same age. But the way that this character is very much devoted to his wife and his family, you wouldn't expect him to cheat. Or,
it,
Maximus.
But yeah. there was even bits where Commodus, okay, says to her, he says to his sister in the first one, he's like, how much has he hurt you? And then she goes,
not as much as I hurt him.
Yeah, no. We've hurt each other as much as whatever it's that that saying, right? And like they just alluded to something happened.
No, the film definitely, 100%.
No, something definitely happened at one point for sure.
Yeah, when they're younger,
but the whole thing of that being his child, but him showing no emotional connection to that child within that film, he's like a betrayal to his character.
But he didn't know.
I feel like you would know.
See, don't forget the whole point of the first Gladiator. The fact was that he can be bought as a slave and taken back to Rome, and nobody recognizes him. Was the difference between him as the general then and the general in the second one, where everybody knew him, right? It was because when he was at war for so long, because Caesar. Right, found him in a different country. Right,
trained talk about Marcus Aurelius.
Yes, yeah. Okay. Trained him to be a general, and then took him to war straight away. And he even says to him, "You haven't been to Rome." Do you know what I mean? Okay, so when Maximus goes to Rome, nobody recognizes him as the war hero. Right. So then I say that, okay, to be like he might have smashed the sister, and then not seen her for like 6 years. But the thing is that when...
I get your issue, though.
No, same.
I get your issue.
I think it's stupid.
Yeah, you can definitely find a reason.
It is feasible that you would have had a child, but it's stupid. The foundations weren't necessarily 100% from the first film, because this film was like 20 years in the working, right? Like this, there was supposed to be a Gladiator 2 how many times until it actually was a feasible concept. So the foundations were never laid in the first film fully, but they left enough crumbs, I guess, for Ridley Scott to say, we can do the nostalgia thing and play off him being...
I saw one of the American content creators, okay, say that if they actually put him finding out that's his son in the first film, it would have actually made the storyline a lot stronger, because then Commodus has another layer as to what to use against him. Do you know what I mean? And then that'll be like a whole different thing. But Maximus doesn't hurt Lucius in the first film because he's a kid, not because that's his son. And I know we're talking about like harming kids here, but there's two differences there, bro. Do you know what I'm saying?
Having
the emotional level then is so much like him dying at the end has 10 times more meaning now. Do you know what I'm saying? Because he's now not like, because the whole film was Maximus preaching that whatever happens, man's dying and I'm going back to my
kids.
Yeah, and he kept saying that.
But he went in to also uphold what he deemed to be, which is one of the strengths of the film, which ties into something, but he also had an adoration for the values and the philosophy of Marcus Aurelius. Now, that doesn't mean Marcus Aurelius was a great man himself.
Yeah.
Because as we see in this film, there's a character who has a completely different perspective of that reign, right? Because he's coming from sort of being under the rule of it, which I actually really like. But yeah, as I said, I just don't think the foundations were strong enough. But at the same time, I don't think it's like my biggest pet peeve. There were so many other things about the film that...
You know what's mad? That they could have written it so that wasn't his son and the story could have still been the same, because he still would have had motivation in terms of the issues they had with Rome, because his wife died.
Yeah.
And she could have still been his mom without Maximus being
his dad.
Yeah. And he still would have had motivation.
And he could have still been like in awe of Maximus.
Yeah, exactly. That didn't need to be written into the film. But yeah.
I hear you. Let's just, whilst we're here, Paul Mescal, who is sort of the darling of Hollywood in a sense. He's this new crop of young actors alongside the
current white boy of the month.
Chalamet. What's my man that was in Bike Riders? Austin Butler, for example. There's like a new generation of young actors.
It's so funny that you named both of them, because they both auditioned for
the role.
For the role.
Yeah. Really? I think this is the one film where people are actually going to see Paul Mescal for the first time. Don't get me wrong, he's been in other films which have done really well and have sort of boosted his career, but I think this is his breakout film, if you like. And I think we're seeing now the effect where he's starting his own production company and so on and so forth. Like, he's really stepping into like this new world of Paul Mescal, I guess. What did you make of his portrayal of Lucius Verus? We'll start with Jason. What did you make of him? His character goes through so many sort of tumultuous feelings and emotions throughout the film. What did you make of his depiction, both from a sort of emotional and action standpoint?
Well, so this was my first kind of like introduction to him because I haven't seen him in the other films that we mentioned, but he was okay. I feel like what he was portrayed to be, so Denzel Washington's character, like, you know, he's like, oh, you know, your main motivation is rage because of kind of like the trauma that he goes through from losing the war, losing his mentor, and then his wife and everything. And I don't think he was ever able to, for me anyway, display the rage that what I think we wanted him to display, if that makes sense. Where, like, he just looked like some any guy. But in terms of kind of like from a physicality aspect, in terms of the action scenes, and that's where I feel like that's where the rage then did come through.
So where were you looking for the rage to come from?
Do you mean like the scenes when he sees his mother and he's
yeah so
like, well, that's not really believable.
Yeah, you know I mean? Yeah, no, 100%. So what, the one scene with when he meets his mum for the first time, and you know, she's telling him like, you are my son, and he doesn't really want to believe it and stuff like that. And then like I just felt like for the feelings that were supposed to come up, yeah, didn't really portray it as well as it could have been.
I disagree with that. I think the issue with Paul Mescal in this film is less, for me, it's less to do with him. I know we as a group might disagree, which is cool. I think the issue with Paul Mescal is his character goes through so much in the film, right? He loses quite a number of people that he either seems to really care about or does really care about. Some of the slaves that he came up with. We can spoil it. He loses his mother. Pedro Pascal's character, I can't remember his name specifically, which again is an issue in of itself, but yeah, my problem with it is that the pacing and the editing and the writing all in one was so choppy, where there was never a time where we could really sit with him in a particular emotion, whether it's joy, whether it's him grieving his wife, because whilst he was driven by the grief of his wife, I didn't actually feel like, it didn't feel like that was the true.
But that's what I mean. Yeah, that's,
because there, like, was so much to get through, right? Okay, I just said, so the pacing is slightly off. I mean, my biggest gripe with his arc was when he did meet his mother, you know what I'm saying? And then he's like, yo, F off. And he's mad at her. He's so pissed, he's fuming.
And then she comes back and they're all buddy, buddy.
Next scene, they're, I love my dog.
Yeah, like,
and
she.
No context. But do you know what? It even seemed like they filmed the context and they just didn't put it in. Do you know what I'm saying?
No, but this is what I was going to say. Like
timing thing.
So I think at this point Manny came in, like, off screen we were talking about, like, you know, the pacing as well. But I think personally, I think this film went through kind of like a whole rewriting process. Like some of the things were cut, some of the things that were in there that could have made a little bit more context were left out, or
I think
just
it was editing, man. I think that rewriting per se. I just think a lot was just taken, like, out of the film.
You think it was taken?
Yeah, I think it was.
And
that makes it.
Ridley Scott has a massive habit, yeah, of doing like 6-hour edits and then just going backwards, right? And he'd done the same thing with
Napoleon.
Yeah, he'd done a very long film and then just cut it all back. And even then, bro, the pacing of
his films are always within the 2.5 to 3 hour mark.
Yeah, so. But then, even then, yeah, it's like, don't aim for like a plus 4-hour edited film and then cut down like actual maybe pivotal scenes. Do you know what I'm saying? Obviously, I'm not like a incredible professional director, okay? But like for me, like just in the process of production, it seems harder. It seems a lot harder, especially like creatively.
Right. No, for sure.
Because you either sacrifice something for the story, or you sacrifice it for the creativity of it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Manny, you are somebody that's sort of, I would say, delved into Paul Mescal's sort of journey, yeah, more recently, maybe this year.
Yeah.
What did you make of his performance, both sort of showing that emotion of his character alongside some of the action scenes, which is also a vital part of his character Lucius in the film due to the nature of the film?
I think Paul Mescal in general is a really, really good actor. So I was kind of disappointed in his performance in Gladiator 2. The action scenes were fine. I think he done those scenes really well.
So good.
Choreographed, especially that scene where he fights in front of the twin emperors for the first time. The hand-to-hand combat, that was really enjoyable, yeah, to watch. My issues with his scenes, I don't feel like he carried the emotional weight, you know, in the different scenes that he should have, in the same way that Russell Crowe potentially done in Gladiator 1.
I agree.
I know that we said that we didn't have enough time to sit through the scenes for us to feel that level of burden that he was carrying. But I feel like great actors should do that instantly. Like, for example, when we get Denzel talking to Lucy's mum, Connie?
That's the actress, Connie Nielsen. I can find Connie Nielsen.
When he reveals that, obviously, he was once a slave by dad, you felt the weight of his emotions in saying that. The scene where he walks into the home of the guy that owes him money, even though it was very comedic, you felt the weight of that scene. Even Russell Crowe...
You felt the tension.
Even Russell Crowe in the first one, where we get a scene of him being apprehended by the Rome soldiers, and then he says, can you please make sure that my family are going to be safe? And the person says, oh, they'll meet in the afterlife, and he switches. You feel the weight in that scene. Or when he is a slave and he's cutting off his arm because the guy asks him, are those not your gods? Wouldn't your gods be upset at the fact that you're cutting off the mark? I can't remember what it was written. Mm. And he just laughs. I felt that. I didn't get those scenes for Paul Mescal. Mm. Right? And yes, he was angry, and we constantly get it. I felt like his emotion was very one-tone.
Again, I think that's because the opening scene in Gladiator 1, allows us to build an aura for Russell Crowe immediately, right? Because he's commanding this huge army and not only that, he's involved, right? Mm. They tried doing that with Paul, but Paul just seemed like any soldier, right? That he was there and he happened to be a good fighter, and he lost that. Do you understand? Like he didn't only lose. Okay, he saw his female wife get shot up here, and the mad thing is, they went into that scene, he was confident, he was laughing with her, he was joking with her. Da, da, da. You know what I'm saying? Okay, they're trying to build an aura, but it just wasn't done. And then from then on, okay, he had an uphill battle with us to even have like an emotional
connection. Yeah. But I think that goes back to what Gaz was saying about like more the editing, more not like while I do agree with Manny in the sense of like great actors should be able to capture you like the moment they're on screen, but I will definitely agree more with Gaz here as well, where it's like the editing, like the first, like his wife gets killed like within the first 10 minutes, and it's just like we didn't feel any emotional weight, like as you said, like you couldn't build any sort of aura around it, and it's like the funny thing is like she gets killed, but then we get this what is supposed to be this super emotional kind of like, you know, cutscene where he's, you know, dreaming, having this delusions of his wife going kind of like in the afterlife and stuff like that, and then like him screaming after her in slow-mo. I don't even remember her name.
I didn't enjoy that,
and he shouts after her, and it's like, bro, this is in the first 10 minutes, like you don't even let us sit with that feeling of like, oh shit, he just lost his wife and stuff like that. And I think I would even go as far to say that goes with his mentor as well, who just like kneels and gets himself deaded off by monkeys. It's like, bro, come on, man.
Did you ask my dear? You see, Gladiator 1, if the dog died in Gladiator 1, I would have felt him more than I did in what happened in Gladiator 2.
You mean with his wife?
Yeah, I would have felt more for the dog.
Oh, so dumb.
No, but I think that is one of those things where it's just like, maybe it's not even an editing, but like just a whole directing issue at that point where it's like you have to fault Ridley for that and be like, yo. Yeah.
I think he's from what I gathered, from what I've seen, he did a lot of those sort of action sequences himself, which I think was very impressive.
Dope.
And I think he was really, really good in those. So I think there's a duality, there's like a difficulty. I think he was hampered by the writing and the editing. The writing is an issue with his character, not just the editing.
There's
also an issue with a lot of characters. Do you know what I mean?
All the characters.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is takes me on to, I'm going to glaze. This is my glaze sesh. So if you guys want to call me a glazer.
I'm glazing too, don't worry.
Nah, we're all in agreement here.
For me.
You need to adjust your, just do the adjustment.
Oh. Listen, bro. Bro, I've been trying to.
Yeah.
Bro, Denzel Washington for me,
Woo!
Which is also an issue. I spoke about this with somebody. If he wasn't in this film, I don't know if I would have enjoyed this film half as much.
Oh, no.
For sure. 100%. For sure.
I think the more I thought about it, the more I actually think he carries the film.
Yep.
I thought he was utterly mesmerizing. I thought he commanded the screen. I spoke about it with you, I think. We know he's a theatre actor. We know that's where he's grew up. I know that's your realm and you love that as well. And you could really feel the theatrical, dramatic, flamboyant nature to his character. Where the film also almost delves into like a camp, flamboyant, Yeah, those are the words I would use to describe the way the film delves into, and I think he's a big part of that. Yeah. I think he really commands the screen in every single scene he's in, from a physicality perspective, as well as his acting and his tonality, and he carries a sort of...
His hands.
Carries... Yeah. Carries... That's where I was leading to, with sort of his sort of actions with his gowns and his clothing and his rings and his manoeuvring around certain scenes, the way he manoeuvres around the set, the way he moves around his actors, where you could really feel this is a man that is really... so well versed in what he does and believes in his acting ability beyond anyone else on this screen or on the set. I really, really enjoyed his performance as Matt Crinus. But there's also the duality of his character also having quite a heartfelt story, which drives a lot of his motivations, which I think was probably the strongest writing of the film from an acting perspective, because we don't know too much about him, but it slowly unravels where we get to see his motivations, because he was under the rule of Marcus Aurelius for God knows how long as a slave, which drives his sort of uprising to power and the way he's able to manipulate and sort of coerce in his Machiavellian way the two emperors. Brilliant performance.
It's almost like
brilliant.
It's almost like a Game of Thrones, like King's Landing type.
Littlefinger.
Yeah. Where like
Littlefinger-esque.
Where like he's been in Fleabottom and he's been here and then he's been here and he's been here and he's been like, so like he's lived throughout like every part of I guess Roman society, do you know what I'm saying, and he can almost see the top, you know. But like obviously I remember we came out of the screening, Kate, and I said to you the only thing that I would have loved more is actually probably less of the film of what we saw and 10-15 minutes more of him. Okay, like seeing him, that Senate scene, that Senate scene was Training Day-esque, bro. Like, that Senate scene was outstanding, fam. He was breathtaking. And the worst thing is, okay, why, instead of just rushing to the fucking and killing off, what's his name? Pedro, right? And killing off, what's our brother called? What's his name?
One of the Emperor.
Connie, right? Oh, killing Connie. All these people off, it could have waited. Or just don't do it, yeah, okay? Could have just waited. But give us 10 minutes of Denzel manipulating the nation. Do you know what I'm saying? He got power, and then that scene was incredible, that Senate scene. Amazing. Now.
Then it rushes to the battle.
Give us 2-3 more scenes, okay, where he is working his magic behind the scenes. Build the actual anticipation for the final battle, but they relied on the love of the mother and thing. It was weak.
And spectacle as well.
Yeah, it was such a weak direction to go in after such a mad scene. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, that scene woke me up. I was like, oh, okay, here we go. Do you know what I mean? And then it just goes left, instead of going in what I think is the right path. You know what I'm saying? No pun intended.
I think you, and I think I can imagine you two agreeing, or all three of you to be fair. I really like the fact that we gain different perspectives of a human being that's not even involved in the film in terms of Marcus Aurelius. He's sort of sold to us as a philosopher and a man of people who wants the best for what Rome should deserve, right? But then
they keep talking about his dream.
Exactly, right? Which is what drives a lot of Maximus's actions in the first film, yet we have Macrinus, who has a completely alternative perspective of Marcus Aurelius as a man and his rule, which, again, as we said before, drives his actions. Manny, how did you feel about that?
That's probably my favourite aspect of the film,
right?
In terms of Marcinus's perception of what Rome is and is meant to be, and him, not in so many words, but wants to burn it all down so we can restart again. And the way that drove his motivation. Again, that scene where he's telling... Connie.
Connie Nielsen.
I remember her real name, but I can't remember
the character's name. Let me find it.
Lucilla.
I knew that already. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Him telling Lucilla that he used to be a slave under her dad's rule, like changed the whole perception of his character and his motivation.
Even her, by the way. Like we now look at her differently.
I think I looked at her dad differently.
I think slightly. He looked at her dad differently.
For sure.
He's not this perfect man that just had a dream that wanted everything to be great. Even though we do understand in the first film,
he admits it.
Yeah, he said that. Like Rome is turned to something that it shouldn't be, and wants to change.
And he said by himself, he was like, when I die, will people remember me as
a tyrant, or
as a tyrant, a philosopher, a this and that. Do you know what I'm saying? He's self aware, and that's the reason why after 8 years of war, he said that he's been in rule for 20 years, and in 4 of those years had peace.
Yeah,
right, and then. So he was giving the Caesarship, obviously, to Maximus to then take it away from the Senate. You know, do you know what I mean? So then it can...
Who are corrupting themselves.
Yeah. But he's doing that after already, corrupting half the world. Do you know what I'm saying? So he's, even though, we see him as, oh, that's so lovely, he's also kind of a cunt. Do you know what I mean? He colonised a lot of countries.
Yeah. Jason, I think the Denzel Glaze was a good glaze. It was a good glaze. He deserves all the plaudits.
Deserves all the plaudits.
That's definitely an Oscar potential nominee. Not even potential, Oscar nominee. Yeah. There was two other actors in this film who caught my intrigue. Joseph Quinn and Fred Hechinger, who were the two emperors in Emperor Caracalla and Emperor Geta.
Which one's which?
I think Quinn was Geta.
Yeah.
And Hechinger was Caracalla. Okay. I think. But yeah, we know they were the two emperors.
Yeah.
What did you make of their performance? And the reason I really asked this question is because I feel as though their performance will divide opinions in terms of people's perspective of this film. And I think their performance alongside Denzel's sort of drives the tonality of this film, which differs from the first in terms of that sort of...
The campiness,
the theatrical, flamboyant tone, which completely differs from the first film, which is grounded and stoic and theatrical. This film leans into the pantomime-esque nature of it. What did you make of their performances? I really enjoyed them, but I know this might divide people.
I think, now that you mention it, because honestly, when I watched this film, I didn't even think that it would cause a divide personally, because I thought like Roman history in general, as far as we're aware, has always been a little bit more flamboyant, and I don't want to say gender fluid, but in the sense of sexuality, a lot of men were into men in whatever way or form. The way they defined masculinity then is different, but I guess now that you put it into context with how Gladiator was a lot more stoic, it was a lot more, I guess, traditionally masculine.
It's very 2000.
Is different. But with Joseph Quinn in particular, I think he was the best performance for me. And then Denzel, a very, very close second. The way he was able to, as the emperor, with his brother as well, the flamboyant nature, as you said, pantomime, evilness and the flamboyant nature, they just turned it up to 11. And every scene that they were in, I was just like, okay, cool, we're here for a good time. And then when they linked up with Denzel, it was just like, okay, cool, these are the best parts of the film. Yeah. Their dialogue, while the dialogue overall wasn't the strongest point, but between the three of them, that was when they were at their best.
It was the plotting that all three of them thought they were doing. And then it was like they were in scenes together, but they weren't.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? Okay, because you're getting they all kind of what's his name? Denzel's character, he wants them to think a certain thing, right? And then they're going away and they're thinking that that's their own thoughts. They've been played into a situation. And then the worst thing is that Emperor Geta, right? He thinks that he's manipulating his brother or this whole time, while Denzel was actually still manipulating him. Do you know what I mean? So he's so blinded by doing the same thing that Denzel was doing to his brother that he's not concentrating on what's happening to him. Do you know what I'm saying?
Do you know what? And I guess I'll talk a little bit about the positives in terms of the thematic ideas of the film and stuff like that. How sometimes brothers, especially in brothers in high position, can have or build a certain superiority complex or inferiority complex, actually, with the... Is it Geta? The one...
Geta's the older one, no? That's Queen.
Okay, no. Emperor... Oh, my God.
Caracalla.
Yeah. Caracalla, towards the end, where Denzel's he looks to blame you for this thing. And then he has this little speech about nothing was ever mine. It's always been ours.
Ours, yeah.
And then it's just great. That really, that was actually such a not such a powerful scene, but like one of the most powerful scenes of the film that plays into this whole idea of like certain, sometimes like, you know, as much as you love your family, especially your sibling, you can build a sort of inferiority complex if one is clearly outshining you, which Joseph Quinn's done. Like you see it in the Colosseums, you see it in the first time with the hand-to-hand combat when they're fighting, when Paul Mescal's character's fighting. Like he's always the one driving the conversation. He's always the one kind of like leading the people. He's speaking to the people. And like, again as well, like Emperor Kaukala is gay, very much clearly. I'm not sure if it's ever stated, but he's gay, which...
I think it's fluid.
He might be fluid, but Emperor Geta even mentions it. He's like, yo, like his disease from the groin is going into his head, in the sense that like,
it's crazy,
yeah, or something along those lines, where it's like his sexuality like clearly is an issue, and Emperor Geta does have a problem with it. That's why he's always kind of like making sure that he's the one who has the final say, he's the one in charge, which builds that resentment, if Emperor Kaukala was aware of it or not, something that Denzel's character really tapped into, and he was like, look man, he's
I really like the scene with Denzel talking to the younger one. He said that, yeah, did you know that when we were inside my mama's womb, he tried to choke me?
Yeah.
Like, you remember that?
Yeah, that was jokes. He was like, you remember that, didn't you? Like, yeah, fair.
I think those two together
was gold.
I need more of them.
Yeah. I needed them three.
Which
like
would have allowed the film, I guess, to further explore the sort of Roman political sphere, right, and the sort of Machiavellian nature of people within politics, and how self-serving people in politics and people of power can really be. That would have been really cool for the film to delve a bit more into that, which it didn't necessarily get to do. One of the other aspects of the film, which I wanted to just touch on briefly, because we have a lot to get through, is the way in which, and I think the first film did this as well, is the way in which it sort of, the action was so visceral and so engrossing to watch for me, but it also depicts like the barbaric nature of slaves, of gladiators, of that being a form of entertainment, which is still rings true in today's world, whether we like it or not. When we watch boxing, when we watch combat sports, there is still a barbaric nature of like enjoying seeing somebody hurt somebody else or injure somebody else, which the first film did, and I think the second film did so as well. And I think with certain characters, with Russell Crowe's Maximus, for example, and his sort of reluctance to fight in certain instances, was that film delving into that. And I think we see that in glimpses with Lucius as well, but not as profound as with Russell Crowe's Maximus. But that leads me into one of the issues with the film, which I think a lot of people feel it was just too on the nose with the callbacks and the references.
Oh, when he got caught as a slave and then taken, Evan, there's the same scene where Barbara is like, okay, fight, Evan. He like refuses to fight.
It was the
same thing as when he gets to the fucking Colosseum, gets his sword, puts it down, does the whole with the sand. And the thing is, how would have he known that? You know what I mean? And they're saying that it's like muscle memory because the kid was there.
I mean, he did say he's seen him fight.
Yeah, but he didn't even clock that was his... Bro, anyway.
No,
take inspiration.
I guess, well, like, to do a mild defense of it, it's like, okay, it...
You don't have to be that forward with, like...
No. But I think...
This is where Manny said it wouldn't pass on turning in because you've taken so many
aspects from
either character moments or plot lines and story moments from the first into the second, where you could have taken inspiration from the first but given us a completely different film in a time that's moved on from 2 decades from the previous film, instead of giving us essentially
a bar for bar recreation of it.
Yeah,
it's called a Gladiator, the Maximus Legacy.
No, I mean, like, I think that goes, I think, with, I guess, with the issues as well, like the callbacks are like as you said, two on the nose. I do think like the whole idea was like, oh, do you remember this? Yeah. Do you remember when this happened? Oh, yeah. his
film 24.
Yeah, remember, and it's just like to a certain degree, like I'm somebody who loves callbacks. right?
Yes.
I love a callback. So I wasn't, I'll be honest with you, I wasn't too mad at it. I wasn't too mad. I was just like, okay.
I just think you can be a bit more gracious and a bit
more. Well, the thing is, like, the gracious callbacks in the films is like having the old Senate, which is the same cast, the same people, in that little, you know, thingy tunnel with Lucilla. Yeah, Lucilla.
Even like, I liked
Matt. That was a pretty cool one.
Matt Lucas's character was like, I can't remember who played the initial guy that was sort of the commentator.
With the ginger hair.
But
yeah,
I enjoyed that sort of, we kept tradition. Yeah. So like Matt Lucas is like the evolved or the newer version of that character. Mm. I thought Matt Lucas was funny as well.
Yeah, of course.
But yeah, it was too much.
Even having Denzel play the role that he played, which is obviously a role that the guy with the white hair played in the first one. Like all of that was even the role that Denzel, the guy that he was like betting with.
Oh yeah.
Even that guy had a role in the first one. Well, not him.
I don't mind that.
Which is calm. Do you know what I'm saying? But those are relevant callbacks where you go, oh, that's pretty cool.
I hear it. I hear where you're coming from.
Do you know
I hear
what? The training scene pissed me off because it was, how could, like that's crazy to me. Like, so what? so Russell Crowe, okay, if he Maximus here, doesn't beef, he gets banged like 2-3 times, okay, he doesn't beef, and then the next day he beefs everyone and murks it, right? And then they alluded to it, like, so he gets hit, this is in Gladiator 2, right? Mm-hmm. Gets hit, doesn't beef, he's like, yeah, cool. Hit again, doesn't beef, cool. And when he's about to hit him again, everything starts beefing. So that's the only difference now, right? But it's like, you didn't have to do that first part. Just beef. Just fight back.
Yeah.
But I don't get it. Like, I just don't get it. And if he never knew that was his father, right? Okay, and even though if he saw it the first time around, if he didn't know that was his father, how does he know the morals or standpoint or anything that he stands for? Do you understand? He doesn't even remember his mother. Deep down.
He did remember his mom.
No, like, eventually.
No, he
pretended. No, he pretended. I think he was pretending.
He remembers his mom right away.
He knew
who his mom was. Yeah.
But he just felt betrayed.
Child.
he was being a child that feels as though he's been let down by his family and by his mother particularly.
Kind of has. But he was
given away.
Yeah.
For protection, but obviously his perspective of
that. Allegedly.
Completely different. Are there any other issues or positives we want to talk about before we move on to some of the other films?
Costume design. That is fucking brilliant.
Oh, I thought you were gonna say it's an issue.
That's definitely, I can see that being definitely Oscar.
Man, like Denzel, you know.
Yeah.
Listen, give me some. I need more gold rings and gold earrings, man.
For sure.
I'm saying Halloween 2025.
I need some.
Yes.
I'm running.
If you see me with some great, don't even get me started. Hey, Denzel. Nah, he was cold. And I think aspects of the visual were good in terms of like capturing the grand nature of Rome, of the Colosseum, but then there were issues with the CGI.
I think the CGI animals were
an issue. Some people took issue with the Colosseum being underwater, but that's actually a thing that occurred during sort of Roman rule. So that was actually a thing that occurred. So yeah, I saw some people having.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah, I thought
I don't care about historical accuracy to that point, bro.
Some people are like,
some people are just going to be iffy about it, which I think they're right too. But I like, if something looks good, it looks good.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
If the film was presented as based on a true story, I hear it, but it's not, bro.
it takes glimpses of that. Let's give our ratings for the film then, because we've got a lot to get through. Manny, this is going to be interesting. Give me your rating for Gladiator 2 out of. Hossam prefers 10, so let's do 10s.
5.5.
Hoss?
I'm going to go a 7.2.
Okay, 6.
I initially had a 7.5. I'm going to go with like a 7. I'm going to go with a 7. I like the film, but yeah, there are issues. I think what I enjoyed, I think Denzel might be clouding my judgment a bit, but yeah, I
think that's fair. Like, if it's one thing, like one of the biggest positives come out that, surprise, surprise, a go actor is a go actor.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a good closing for that segment. We'll move on. I'm going to try and get through as many films as we can. Huss, you watched Venom recently. And I think it's a film we should talk about briefly just because it's a film we watched. Shout out to Sony for the invite to that film. That film's trash.
Really? Surprise.
That film stinks.
No, but the first one's not bad, bro. You know what I'm saying?
The first one's not bad. The sequels have been...
The first one's good, you know.
The first one's good, bro.
I like the first one.
And the
second one's trash.
The second one is trash.
The second one...
Carnage is trash,
like,
bro.
Like, spectacularly, it's fine. But nah, the writing
trash.
Is awful.
It's trash, bro.
But the writing is awful. It is awful.
Pacing was bad as well. It's like an hour and 30 minutes and you...
Yes. Yeah, I don't know why they keep doing that, but this one wasn't that long either, bro.
And it stank. Sorry, Sony. We have to be honest. I don't think the film's good. It barely has any redeemable traits. Other than you can see, I guess, that Tom Hardy did this sort of thing for his son, whose son loved Venom as a character, I believe. That's why he took on this project. And Tom Hardy's good in the film. I've seen him better, but he was good. But the film...
Had no meaning, bro. He lost the whole meaning of Eddie Brock, okay? Like, we don't even touch on his job or, like, the continuation from the second one. So, they think that the continuation is that he's on the run. He got framed for something. And all of the plot lines were so weak here, just to get to the symbiote army, right? Like, that's what they were trying to fucking get to, right? They had a villain that we never eventually saw. And
if, just, and speak I speak on it. Noel was they did the worst thing ever with Noel. They introduced him in the first 10 minutes, and that's about it.
Well, one of the
but
most
I just
dynamic
didn't give a shit, didn't like, care,
bro.
He's barely in the film anyway.
But he's one of the most dynamic comic book villains of all time, bro.
The plot device they did where, oh, if he turns into Venom, then he's going to get found by one of Venom's fucking creatures. I don't care, remember what the creature was called.
Yeah.
And they come after him every time, and then he's like, oh, I want to dance with so-and-so, so I'm going to turn into Venom to get caught.
No sense.
Just, the film's just dumb. It's actually just dumb.
Yeah. Just no, dumb. No.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
It's a dumb film.
But I disagree with everyone.
I can't just remember what I liked about the film now.
I liked...
Tom Hardy.
I liked...
It was okay. That was the most enjoyable part.
Even that. Oh, bro! I said something. Didn't I? I said even the doctor lady, fam, and she had her arm.
Juno Temple.
Was, huh?
Juno Temple's character.
Whatever that one. Yeah.
We have to be respectful to the actors, though.
Nah, she was stupid too. She was really horrible. She was
as the never, character
you're not
in the
speaking
film.
Speaking to them one day, so we should
love you. She was really horrible. Okay. She was really really bad at her job. But like the writing was so bad. And that that scene where she was in bed, and then we get like the flashback of her and her brother, and then she gets like a thunderstorm that hits her, and then safe. And then you don't even clock here, because obviously there's like veins on her arm. You don't clock until like three scenes later, yeah, where she's putting on her thingy, lab coat, and then she's like doing this because she can't
move
her arm, and I'm like. Okay, like, so you can't move your arm. What is the sympathy that we're feeling for you?
Film just dumb, man.
It made no sense, bro. Like, and even like the motivations of the other doctor, the mixed race lady, she was great, but at the same time, it's just like her motivations were so confused. Like everything, even and I hate to say this because I love him. I can never say his name, man. He's a fantastic actor. The one that was in Doctor Strange,
Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Yeah, like he.
Sorry,
Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Yeah, even.
What,
him.
You thought I said it wrong?
No. I just didn't know how to pronounce it.
Oh yeah,
so I just wanted to. Yeah,
he's I had to learn. Don't I?
I did not know how to pronounce it. So right. Hearing it out loud for the first time, I'm like, oh. Okay.
Remember, I'm British as well, so like when I say it, it sounds proper geezer. So it's gone.
But like. Even with him, like I've always said about him, he's the James Milner of like black cinema. Like this,
he's
guy
wasted in the film.
Will give you a solid
six or seven out of ten all the time
in any film that he's in. Any film that he's in, okay, he'll be solid. Right?
Even if the film's trash.
Even if the film's trash, he'll be solid. And again, he was calm, but he was in the lower end of the James Milner performances. Do you know what I'm saying? And yeah,
he did what he could with.
He did what he could. Yeah. He did what he could. And if anything, he was. Him and Tom Hardy were the best parts of a failing film. But please, let's move on. That saga's done, and I guess Tom Hardy's now teasing he's actively pushing that he wants to be in a Spider-Man film. So.
I think a quick one on Kraven, which is out next month. I'm just not looking forward to it, and I really think I should. Kraven's like such an interesting character in the Spider world, but it speaks to, I guess, the issue with Sony having the rights to Spider-Man and this whole controlling of IP and making films for the sake of making films, rather than making a film because you care about a character or you care about flushing out a fully engrossed story. Like, but just, oh, let's get Morbius and make a film about Morbius. Who cares about Morbius? No one. If there's no Spider-Man or there's no heart to Morbius' story, I don't care.
I think with Sony's ownership of Spider-Man and Disney,
then they go and make A Crossing Into. How do you?
That's what I was gonna say. Like, I think it's just such a mixed bag. And while I do agree with the idea, like, I personally think that Sony should keep the Spider-Man IP, mainly because we get the Spider-Man games and they have been 10 out of 10 as of late. But with like, they are so hit and miss sometimes with kind of like the IP, because they gave us the Sam Raimi trilogy, right? Which,
how long ago though, bro?
No, but this is what I mean. Like, there's hit and miss where now we've got the Tom Holland, which I guess is in tandem with Disney, where, you know, people might differ on where the best parts are, whether it's on Sony's side or Disney's side. And then, but we get Morbius, we get not Spider-Woman, Mrs.
Madam Web.
Madam Web.
One of the most awful.
What was you gonna say?
Mrs. Web. Madam Web and
Spider Woman sounds way worse though.
Spider Woman would have been bad for me.
Bad for me.
That's what he said.
Oh, sure.
No, I said and then I stopped myself.
When we play back.
Check the VAR. But like, as you said, like, you get Into the Spider-Verse and across the Spider-Verse, is it? Yeah, which is absolutely insane. Like, quite frankly, you know, industry defining films, and we just gotta take anyway, we move on.
Is there anything that you want to talk about in terms of films or shows or even theater shows that you've been to see recently before we delve into some of the releases?
It's a bit similar to Gladiator. I went to watch a theater show called, I butchered this, Cornelius.
Right.
Was essentially about this Roman soldier, and just all that theatrics. It stars my guy. Let me get up his name. 1 second.
Cornelius.
I said my guy. That's how you know that you like the actor.
That is cool.
Oh, damn, dog.
Oh, man.
No. Bro, National Theatre. Sorry.
That's all good.
But yeah, it's a theatre show in the National Theatre. I'm not sure if it's still running. I'm pretty sure it's going to end sometime soon. Mm-hmm. By David Oyelowo.
Okay.
You've definitely seen him, bro. He's in quite a few things. He's a really good actor, though. He's a good performer.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the only big one that I've seen recently. Mm-hmm. I recently going to theatre because my weekdays are now freed up. I went to watch a theatre show at a Bush Theatre called Wolves on Road that has... somebody from he started in Dune 2, Hassan something. Uh-huh. Surname, my apologies. A person that was in for Black Boys, again, names are escaping me, but it's a decent show. It's about cryptocurrency, in terms of, and also dived into the issues that people in communities that don't earn that much as a community seek quick ways to make money, and how they are exploited, especially in neighborhoods and areas that are, I guess, non-white, minorities. Well-written show, could have been acted a bit better, but yeah, it's decent. But next time, I'll have a bit more talk about theatre shows, because now I'm fully back watching
them.
Yes,
sir. I went to watch Jura 2 recently, which is Clint Eastwood's supposed last film ever. I think he's in his 90s now, which is mad. Damn. 96 or something.
Brother, apparently. Relax, brother.
What?
He needs to relax.
Oh, he needs to relax. Yeah, no, yeah. Still making films at that age is mad. And if this is his last film, it's a good film to go out with. So the film stars the likes of Nicholas Hoult, directed by Clint Eastwood, written by Jonathan Abrams. Nicholas Hoult, Toni Collette, J.K. Simmons and Kiefer Sutherland are in the film. It's quite a contained, like, sort of small film, which I think works in his favour in terms of Clint Eastwood. Nicholas Hoult is the lead. He plays a guy called Justin Kenny, who's like the central character. And he's summoned for jury duty. And whilst he's on jury duty, he hears the case being read out, and he finds out that he may have been the person guilty of the case that he's on jury duty for, which is a very interesting premise. And it sort of follows his journey of trying to navigate the duality of, well, am I guilty or not? And if I am, should I be honest? But if I'm honest and I'm not guilty, And that's the sort of struggle. That's the struggle you go through throughout the film. Nicholas Holt was incredible as always. He's like really, really good in the film. Toni Collette was good as well. Really enjoyed her character.
Underrated, you know?
Who, Nicholas? Yeah, probably. I'd say so. He's done really well for himself, but I agree. And he can use his knowledge to sort of either sway the jury one way or another. And he's struggling with that throughout the film. But he also has a family. He's got a wife and she's due to have a child. So he's also having to deal with the struggle of like looking after his family, and I need to be there for my family.
What era is it in?
Era. Oh, it's modern day.
Nice.
Okay. Yeah, it's modern day.
Because obviously the artwork looks like it can be any era.
Oh, okay, got you. But I really enjoyed the film because it's well paced. It kind of moves sharply. Still got that tension of a courtroom drama, but more of the tension in the film was actually in the jury room, where it's less in the courtroom and more in the jury room where the rest of the jurors essentially want to go home to their families and go back to their day-to-day.
You hear that, Joker 2?
There's a lot more drama in between those characters who are striving to get back to their homes, and the film delves into the struggles and the sort of terminus nature of being a juror and wanting to just have your normal life back, because it completely takes over your entire life.
I'm watching this.
Yeah, it's a good film, man. Because Warner have done something weird where it's had such a limited release. I think it may even already be out of UK cinemas, but in America it's in like 36 theatres across the country. So it had a proper limited release. It's going to be on streaming DSPs within the next... I think it's going to be a Christmas film. If it's on Netflix, if it ends up on Netflix, it'll be the number one for a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Rating?
I'd give it like a... It's better than Gladiator. Yeah, it is.
Okay.
I'd give it a 7.5, leaning towards an 8, but mainly because the acting performances are really, really good. Pacing's great. It's well written. It's concise. It's very grounded, but also very... What's the word I'd use for it? It's not enclosed, but give me a word, guys. Help me out. It's concise. Contained and concise. Yeah. It's a good film, man. Toni Collette was really good as well. She's the lawyer. And she's an Aussie. She's really good in the film. I just think it's a good film. It's really enjoyable. It's a good mid-budget, contained.
I like film. Those 50 mil, 25 mil.
Yeah, this was 35. Which is still within that mid-budget realm, right?
Yeah.
Within the realm of cinema, not the money we're spending on it per se. When you compare it to
Gladiator
or Mission Impossible or F1 that are coming out
even
next year.
Even
Joker 2.
It's not what we're about to talk about. Just what you say. Red One.
And the film makes you... You know what the one thing the film does, which I forgot to mention, is it takes you back to moments of the night where the incident occurred, crime.
Like flashbacky remake stuff?
Flashbacks, and it gives you different perspectives where you kind of have to piece together what's happened.
I love a good flashback.
Yourself. Yeah. I don't know how to read that, to be fair. But yeah, it's Juror 2 is a good film. It's a good film. It's a film like people won't go to the cinema to watch, but they should. But if you watch it at home on Netflix...
Like the holdovers.
Exactly. But if you watch it at home on Netflix, you're going to have a good hour and 45 of a time.
So. Oh, that's...
I'm done.
Really, in terms of timing as well,
I'm done.
Nice. Yeah, good film. Fair.
Good film. Red One.
Before you guys dive into that, you know there's like certain actors that when you see the name or thing...
You trust the film.
Like, for example, like, is Zendaya's in a film, I'm looking forward to watching it.
Yeah.
Nice.
Austin Butler, I think he's a really good actor.
He's been up there.
Even like obviously Denzel, like the typical classics. When I know that Dwayne The Rock Johnson, I will purposely go on my way not to watch that film. I just not. You cannot pay me to go watch The Rock.
Hold up. So, thank you to Warner for inviting us to Red One. Okay. But. It wasn't bad.
Guys.
Listen.
No, go on.
Let me land.
Because okay. I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it.
We came out of the screening.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All the black people had different feelings. Okay. All right. A lot of them had very, in my opinion, I thought it was fickle feelings. All right. Me and, shockingly, Bisola, we shared the same opinion. Which doesn't make my point stronger.
It doesn't. Because liking the film makes so much sense to me.
Yeah, okay, wait. These men came out of it like it was a Marvel classic. Like, as in, it was like, but why did they do this for? It doesn't make sense. I'm like, brother, it's a Christmas film. It's based on magic and the feeling of love, right? Why the hell are we sitting here, okay, being like, but how did he catch him though? Because he's too quick. How did that even happen? I was like, bro, sharp, bro. It made no sense. Like, listen, I promise you now, yeah, as a at home, you don't have to go to cinema. As an at home to watch with the family, yeah,
no,
not with the man them, yeah, okay, but with the family or somebody, yeah, and it's your first film out of like three films that you might watch in a Christmas marathon because you're all off work, yeah, it's a solid film for that.
All right, before you go on further, give us a synopsis for the people who haven't watched it.
Basically, okay, the film follows the story of like Santa Claus, who's played by J.K. Simmons, right? He's fantastic in the film, be honest.
J.K. Simmons is just quality anyway.
Cool. Yeah, all right, okay. Goat actors doing goat things. Yeah. But anyway.
Come. He plays Santa, a hen Santa, by the way, right? And then the operation of Christmas, okay, is kind of shown instead of like a classical Nordic light, it's shown in like a modern a tone with like high tech equipment. Mm. The sleigh is like some super quick crazy sleigh, but obviously still runs on the power of the reindeers. So I'm like, little things like that, right? Mm. And then the US government know about the existence of Santa. They got a code name for him, right? And then he actually goes across the road when it's not for Christmas, getting to know people and being in like malls and stuff, but he's seen as like a presidential type figure. Now The Rock plays his CIA type bodyguard, you know, his elf bodyguard, right? And then
The Rock is an elf in this,
technically, yes.
Okay.
He's one of Santa's little helpers.
Okay. Yeah. Do you know what? I find that funny.
Right.
But anyway.
Moving forward, Chris Evans, obviously, our Captain America, plays a hacker, like a world incredible, outstanding hacker. His origin's kind of weak. It's like him as like a child at the start that he hates.
That was the best part of the film.
Yeah. Whoa. Yeah. No. That scene was the best part of the film, but it was like
if the film kept that tone, I would have been locked.
Exactly, but they changed the tone quickly. Do you know what I mean? Like in like 2 seconds, it was like, yeah, done.
The first 10 minutes was hilarious, bro.
Yeah, it was hilarious. It was so good.
And after that, it was fucking trash.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
But I'll let you finish.
It was hilarious because Chris Evans wasn't diluted in scenes because he was. Yeah. Do you know what I'm saying? Okay, and him as a comedic actor, I think is really, really good. I think he's fantastic doing it. But he just wasn't given the right amount of scripting in for the rest of the film. But yeah, he joins up with The Rock because Santa has now been kidnapped by like a mythical Christmas spirit person. And they have to work together because he's the best hacker in the world. He can find Santa Evans safe. That's the premise of it. And save Christmas, obviously, in time for Christmas, right? Okay. Cool. Honest to God, honest to guys, I swear to you, yeah, I get it. I get the whole like Dwayne Johnson, like sellable figure type thing where he's just there just to make peas, and I get it. But it is a good film. It's a solid Christmas film. That goes away from the norm of Christmas films, where it's usually extremely grounded and extremely personal. You know what I'm saying? Okay. Whereas this felt more fun, more unrealistic. Okay, but just like a funny, playful family watch. I don't think it's a blockbuster maniac. I just think it's a nice film.
I didn't like it. I fell asleep a couple of times. I walked out once. Had something to do and I didn't want to come back in. It's not a bad film per se, I just didn't care, and that's it. I just didn't care about the film.
Okay.
No, that's it.
He didn't get the Christmas spirit. He missed key parts. The Krampus part was hilarious.
No idea what we're talking about.
Crazy. There's a part with Krampus and him and The Rock have like a swing off type vibe, and it's really funny.
A swing off?
As in like they punch each other, but it's like a okay. What's thingy's thing? Dana White's thing.
Oh, the slap off.
The slap thing. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
It's literally like that, but with Krampus and The Rock, and it's funny. The whole situation's funny because Chris Evans offers him out. He says, "Yo, you guys should do this. The Rock gets sacked one time and he's obviously gonna fucking lose, yeah. And then everyone's like, he's like, yo, I can't win this. It was really funny. It was cute. You know what I'm saying? So yeah, I thought the ending was one of the strongest parts of the film.
A final question from me, just about this film, right? Is The Rock funny in this?
He's stoically funny, like, you know, like he's supposed to be serious.
Okay.
So it's when he's not serious, it's like, oh.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Cool.
Whereas like Chris Evans, what guys makes a fantastic point. The first 10 minutes here, Chris Evans takes the film, and he's funny, and because you just allow him to be him. You know what I'm saying? When The Rock gets involved with his character, like parallelly.
Chris Evans is a funny actor.
He loses his influence in the film, okay. Right? If we're doing a critical breakdown of the film, I don't think this should be a critically thought film. As I know we have a film podcast, right? But I said this then. I said I don't think we should think about this too much.
No, I hear it. I hear it. There are certain films that are just going to be not meant to be thought of. Like it's like okay, I guess it's more in the sense of like. Can we think about critically for its target audience? Like, is this a good children's film?
Oh, that's another problem with the film.
It's not a good children's film.
Who is this film for? Is it for teenagers? Is it for like 14-year-olds? No, because they're going to be like, what am I watching here? Is it for 7 to 8-year-olds? No, because there's too much swearing and there's too much sort of...
See, but that was going to be my question. Like, because...
everyone.
Okay. Anyway, let's move on.
Fair enough, man.
Fairs.
Fair enough. One of the films we covered at the BFI London Film Festival, shout out to DDA and BFI for allowing us to have coverage of the festival, it was Anora, which was...
I haven't seen it yet.
No. Which was...
Can we do a top 10 instead of a top 5? I can't lie to you, bro.
Of the year?
5 is not enough.
Nah, so I...
Not for films, so I can do 5 easy.
I said to guys...
For shows, it'll be tough.
I said to guys that we'll do a top 5 each, as per... And then we'll do a PCS,
top
like a link.
LOL.
What the hell? Sorry, guys. My phone has just started to talk to itself. It's been doing this recently. There you go. We'll do a top 20 or 25 PCS list of films and TV each. Mm-hmm. So then people can like, you know, press the link and then it's like, boom, that's our top 20 of the year.
Okay.
Not each, by the way, as in...
Collective.
To go.
I only ask because I know you rate Anora pretty highly.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking, really? He said top 5, right?
That's what he said.
Yeah, easy.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm going to check it out.
Yeah. I have interesting thoughts about the film. I can see where there will be a group of society that will have an issue with the film. The film follows a character called Anora, otherwise known as Annie, and she is an exotic dancer and a sex worker, which is already like a polarizing sort of
Oscar
topic to dive into.
Yeah. Oscar bait.
Oscar bait, man.
Would you like to tell us how it's Oscar bait?
Because isn't it about like drugs, sex trafficking, and then like then there's like a third theme as well. Like these are very like
heavy subjects.
Heavy, like you know it's the a Dallas Buyers Club theory where it's like it's not much of a story, but because it's based around like his drug addiction and where it allows Matthew.
I see where you're coming from. I mean, I haven't watched the film, but just from topics.
Performance, because he's so out of character, and that's why it gives Oscar bait, which is fine. I'm not even mad at it. But I haven't seen it.
Cool. Yeah, the film follows Anora, played by Mikey Madison, who we spoke to at the London BFI Film Festival. And the film was so highly sort of adored prior, so which really sparked my intrigue anyway, right? And I really, really enjoyed this film that follows her character's journey. She's an exotic dancer and a sex worker. And she meets a guy called Vanya. They end up getting married and they have this sort of whirlwind romance for a particular period of time. The first section of the film, I was really locked in, right? It had this sort of balancing act of drama and humour, which was really, really enjoyable. Mikey Madison was incredible throughout the film as Anora. You could really feel the various aspects of her character where, like, Mikey really engrossed herself in the role. You can see that she did a lot of research into the area of... She is from Brighton Beach, I believe, which is a which is a subsection or it's an area in New York, New Jersey particularly.
Mm. I got really excited for a second.
Why?
You said Brighton. I was going to say, this is a bitch film.
No, no, no. Brighton Beach. Brighton Beach is like a Russian-speaking neighborhood in New Jersey, I think it is. And yeah, like you could see a lot of research went into her character, into the line of work, into the mannerisms and the way you portray yourself as a exotic dancer or a sex worker working in the club. And she really worked the room. She worked the set. She really engrossed herself in that particular character. The second half of the film, or the second section, has a complete change in tone where it becomes really humorous, becomes a comedy, which caught me off guard. And that's probably my biggest issue with the film, which drew me off a bit. I still enjoyed that middle. The middle section is absolutely, it's one of the funniest parts of a film you will see this year. Mm. I guarantee you'll be laughing, but you'll be a bit thrown by
the tonal shift.
Tonal shift. But then the film really brings you back into like, and it takes a while to do so, but by the end of the film, it takes you into who Honora is rather than Annie. Annie's the exotic dancer and the sex worker. At the end of the film, we really see who Honora is for who she is, which I really enjoyed. The middle section, as I said before, when you get to see the film, it's so funny.
But check out.
The tonal shift was a bit too much for me.
Okay.
It's a very graphic film. It doesn't hide away from it being a film about sex workers. So if you're somebody that doesn't want to see sex scenes or somebody that's a bit against those, you might have an issue with it. I think it makes sense. That wasn't even directed to her, because I think that's a general... I see it more and more with people of her age anyway and have an issue with that sort of...
Portrayal
of seeing sex on screen, sorry. For the most part, I think it made sense, us seeing those scenes, because what it does is it puts you in a place of what her line of work is. One, two, you get to see the way in which men, particularly Vanya's character, who's the husband, views her and sex. And there's a particular moment where she says, you don't have to do it this way, you can do it this way, where like sex is seen as a sort of dominating act for a man, when really and truly, there are times where it can be the two of you together engaging in this particular act, which I think she did well in terms of like teaching him that she's not just a tool there to be used. But then technically, you could argue he's paying for that, right? Which is the weird duality of sex work.
Yeah.
But then that's her husband as well now. So then there's that aspect of it.
Yes, you're going too far into it. I'm now starting to feel like I know this film.
fair enough.
Fez. No, we're definitely going to check it out, though.
But yeah, it's a film worth checking out. I really, really enjoyed the film for the most part. The ending of the film is really, really profound. What I was going to say is the other issue with the film I had briefly is I would have liked, it's another issue that I had with Gladiator. I would have liked more time with Annie outside of work.
Mm-hmm.
When I say outside of work, it's her at home. We got one or two scenes of her with her flatmate, one or two scenes of her outside of the club. One or two scenes of her without Vanya, because Vanya is her husband. She's still working, right? But I would have preferred if we got a bit more time to know who she is outside of being an exotic dancer and a sex worker. But the film is really good. I have it highly rated. It's one of my favourites of the year. It's a great blend of drama and comedy.
Okay. Really
good film, man. Sean Baker's done his thing. I know, obviously, we spoke about Sean Baker before.
Yes.
I think it was before we spoke to Mikey Madison. And we were speaking about his journey, starting off with an iPhone and sort of that transitional journey as a director. So, this is probably his biggest and most career defining so far, because it's so highly adored. This film won't be for everyone, though, but it's a good film. It's good,
very good.
Would recommend it, man. Is there anything else that's come out recently that we haven't spoken about?
So,
quick shout out to Agatha.
Quick shout out to Agatha, yeah, go on.
Shout out to
we spoke about it at the beginning, though, no? Briefly. Do you want to delve a bit more into it? Feel free.
Yeah. Well, 1:17 now.
We can go to like 1:20, 30.
Yeah.
Yeah, go on. 10 minutes.
Okay. But yeah, okay, cool. Now, just quick on Agatha all along, right? Is that called Agatha all along?
Yeah.
I was really looking forward to it, and then the start was really quick and really like the first episode was actually so dope. Okay, and then after that, obviously she goes into her trials, and I didn't really fall in love with the setup of the trials. It all felt like one big trick, which I get is part of the play here. But then I was like, well, the reason why we loved Agatha in WandaVision, or even just, you know, getting to see her towards the end of WandaVision, was how like conniving and smart she seemed, you know, at that time. Whereas we got to have like a very dumbfounded Agatha for like three, four episodes. So the middle of it, I really didn't enjoy episodes. I think 3 to 6. Whereas episodes 7 to 9, those three episodes were the best for me in the whole series, and it saved it. And it actually, when I leave it now, I go, you know what? That was such an enjoyable watch. And they tied it obviously to the MCU, which, you know, seems like a must. But they tied it in a very tasteful way, especially with characters that happen to be in it. Have you guys seen it?
No.
Okay.
It's fine.
But there are like important characters, okay, that are going to be in like future MCU films, which we kind of knew about. Do you know what I'm saying? Okay, like the...
There's no shocks.
Yeah. But like the Young Avengers is obviously coming up, and they had to complete that
set
ensemble of people, which I think they have now, you know. And it left a very beautiful ending where kind of the last episode, okay, is like it was a massive homage to the comic books, and which I adored. And then, not that we didn't Agatha 2, but wherever they leave off, it's gonna go into a different film or a different series, which I'm really excited for. It was great. It almost reminded me a little bit of the Penguin, in the sense of like the whole like anti-hero type thing, okay, where like you almost feel sorry for Agatha at the start, but then you realize actually she's kind of a dick. Do you know what I mean? And like halfway
she's
through,
she's a dickhead all along.
Yeah, she's a dickhead all along, and like halfway through, okay, you really want her to lose. Do you know what I'm saying? Okay, you're like, well, no, you're actually a piece of shit.
But then by the final episodes,
you kind of want to win again. Yeah, do you know what I mean? Like it's like insane. So yeah, I would definitely recommend it. It's not long to watch.
Cole recently watched the film. Well, not recently, a few months back. Cool. CNM's Lot, Stephen King film. What is a film based on Stephen King's book? Absolutely arse-cheeks. Top three worst films. Top three worst films I've watched this year. I just wanted to say that. I don't want to talk about what the film is about. It's just cheeks.
I'll round off quickly with The Day of the Jackal. Right now, there's 6 episodes out. We covered it with, as we said, Sky and Now TV.
Have you guys watched all the episodes?
I'm on episode 5.
I'm on 9.
Okay, so you have all the episodes?
Listen, I'll give you my login. You should watch it.
I will.
You don't need to rush to.
No, yeah, that's what I'm going to say. I don't know when I'm going to.
Okay.
But I want to finish it before it finishes.
What are you on?
I haven't started watching it yet.
Man, it's so good.
So many people have said. Right, even yesterday when my mates said, yeah, bro, I'm like watching this, really good. Yeah, da, da, da.
Man, that first episode is crazy.
So many people love it.
We said that to you last time we spoke as well. We said it last week, innit? When we spoke about Penguin, we were saying the first 10 minutes of the episode.
Of
Day of the Jackal.
I'm excited to watch it.
Yeah, you don't need to rush because I think there's another 4 weeks before.
Yeah, as long as I get to it before it's coming to an end, I'll be
it's in my, it's probably going to be in my top 5 of the year.
Probably so.
This top 5 is looking kind of brazy for me still.
For shows, yeah, it's going to...
I think it's okay, yeah. I think you're going to really like it because it gives, like, obviously it's a British TV show, but it's also very much like an international TV show as well. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I think they're in like 8 countries, bro, at some point. Like, it's ridiculous. Do you know what I mean? Like, so, but it's.
Yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to it. I know I'm going to like it.
I think what the, just to like say what I've enjoyed is the meticulous nature of the series from so many standpoints in terms of the costume, the design, Eddie's acting, and the way in which all of his characters' actions as the Jackal are so well planned and thought out, which stays true to the nature of the character and enables him to do what he does to such a high standard continuously. But as the series goes on, without spoiling it, you start to see cracks in the Jackal, but they're like slow cracks rather than, you know...
And they're cracks that he's also noticing. Like, he's also realising, and what he's trying to do is just like paint over it, or sorry, whatever.
Brush over.
Yeah. As quick as possible. Instead of doing what he was doing.
Because he's got a job to do.
Exactly. Which is, yeah.
But, and I think the final strength of the series is that the two leads, as Eddie and Lashana, their characters, the Jackal and Bianca, have stakes. They have things that in their personal lives which impact them doing their jobs, which they're both very good at. But there's a lot more at stake than just the job. And it's that balancing act of trying to look after X, Y, and Z, and in tandem with being the best I can be at my job. But yeah, Eddie as the Jackal, like, mind-blowingly good, bro. Yeah, he was really, really, really impressive. So shout out to Eddie Redmayne. Shout out to Lashana Lynch as well, friend of the show.
Friend of the show.
Did she recognise?
Yeah.
Do you think she clocked you the other day?
Yeah, she was like this, isn't it? She was like, oh, yeah.
Is she?
Yeah.
Okay.
1,000%. It was when Julie said like a joke, and when she turned around, looked at the crowd, and she was like, ha, and she went, ha.
Yeah. Nice.
I didn't think she clocked actually.
Nah,
have some faith, man.
Yeah, physical.
But yeah, shout out to everybody. Listen, we are the Post Credit Scene Podcast, a 14HQ original, lovers of film, TV, and theatre. Make sure to subscribe on YouTube. We're going to be back on YouTube. Well, we are already back, actually, to be fair, with the interview with Lashana. Check us out on all DSPs as well, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all your favourite podcast platforms. Make sure to give us a follow on all socials. We are now on 3,000 followers, 3,014, I believe, on TikTok.
Nice.
Give us a follow. We're closing in on a 1,000 on Instagram as well. I think we're around the 850 mark on Instagram. So make sure to go and follow both platforms. We are putting out a very well thought out and planned content, you know, to promote the work that we do. So make sure to check it out as well. And that's us, over and out.
Yes, sir.
Love people.
Hi, I'm Donald Glover, and you are watching or listening to the Post Credit Scene.